over by the woods was wearing a Spider-Man costume, just like you were.
Yeah.
Did Aiden know you were gonna wear a Spider-Man costume to school? Noah thinks about that.
Probably. Yeah, he probably did.
And it never occurred to you that Aiden set you up?
It crossed my mind, but I didn't know.
And I'm not a rat. I bring a hand to my forehead, push my hair off my face. The second shooter, I mumble.
Yeah, you keep going on about that, says Noah. You're sure two people did this?
I nod. That's the only way it could have happened. So if you didn't do it,
then someone else helped Aiden, says Noah.
And after tonight, I think I know who. I think I know who was working with Aiden, who's been working with him all along. The man who was in Noah's house with my uncle when Lang planted the incriminating evidence to frame Noah. The man who always seems to show up conveniently to rush to Aiden's rescue. The man who demanded that I stop investigating the school shooting, my uncle's murder, all of it. The man who told Aiden tonight,
I'll take care of this.
I have to go, I say.
No, don't.
Noah puts a hand on my shoulder.
You said yourself you can't go home.
I can't stay here.
You could, actually,
he says, his voice quieter. I look at him, his eyes peering directly into mine. He puts his hand on my face and moves in for a kiss. Like a surge of electricity through my body, realizing that I've always wanted this. His hands in my hair, my hand cupped around his neck, letting myself surrender. No, I say, breaking away. I have to go. They'll look for me here. It might not be the first place Isaac looks, but he'll get here eventually.
So let him.
Why? I gather myself, fix my hair. So we both get in trouble? He concedes that.
Where will you go?
I don't know. Hotel, not an option. No cash to my name. And using a credit card would be the same as handing the address to Isaac. Ricketts' house? Negative. Uncle Lang's house? Nope. I already gave back my keys. Someone I can trust, but close by so I don't have to drive the streets very long. Justin, I say.
Justin Rivers? The guy who owns Tasty's?
I nod, suddenly feeling awkward admitting that to someone I just kissed.
I didn't know,
says Noah, taking a step back. No, it's not like that, I say. I mean, we went on one date. Noah's eyes trail away.
Okay, I understand. He's a nice guy.
Hey, I say. And when he looks back at me, I grab his shirt and draw him in and kiss him hard. Then I pull away and leave his house. Chapter 82. I pull my car into the lot at Tasty's Diner and park around the back, out of sight. There's only one other car in the lot, Justin's Jaguar. I walk in and find him behind the bar, reading something on his laptop. I admit, one of the reasons I came here tonight was the small chance that I might run into Aiden Willis, who apparently spends a lot of nights at Tasty's drinking. But no luck. Justin is here alone. Hey there, he says when he looks up, not unhappy to see me. Slow night? I ask. It picks up in the summer, he says. He looks me over.
You doing okay?
I take a long breath.
You must not be,
he says, coming around the counter, walking up to me, unsure of how close to get, whether to touch me. The whole awkward thing again. I give him the short version of my lovely evening, that in the course of investigating my uncle's murder, I may have bent the law tonight and found myself on the wrong end of an arrest warrant. I don't know for a fact that I'm wanted for questioning, I say, or that an arrest warrant was issued. But my guess is they're looking for me.
You need a place to stay,
he says.
You can't go home.
Well,
that's no problem. You can stay at my place. I have plenty of room.
If you're sure it's not a bother, I say. Technically, you wouldn't be harboring a fugitive.
but you might want to give this some thought. He thinks about it for a moment. I've always wanted to harbor a fugitive. I laugh in spite of the circumstances. He looks at the clock on the wall. It's 1:30 in the morning. Let's go, he says. Nobody's coming at this point. We take our own cars. I follow him into East Hampton, checking my mirrors at all times, feeling very conspicuous out here on Main Street at this hour. But I don't see any patrol cars. Justin has a house by the ocean, a beautiful 2-story cedar A-frame. I park my car next to his in the garage, and he lowers the door, shielding my car from any inquisitive law enforcement. Inside, he leads me to a family room. What a place. Clean and spacious and updated. He directs me to a couch that's more comfortable than my bed, perched next to a floor-to-ceiling window overlooking a large backyard. I sink into the couch, exhausted. Next to me, on a side table, are 2 framed photographs of Justin as a child. The first with his mother and father at a Yankees game. Justin must have been, what, 4 or 5? All of them wearing Yankees caps, smiling for the camera. Justin looking like a miniature version of his father. The second, just the boy and his mother, when Justin is older, probably 10 or so, on the beach, the Atlantic Ocean as a backdrop. Nice family, I say. Yeah, Justin nods at the photographs. That's the last photo I have of my father. He died 2 days later. Crazy, right? Gosh, I'm sorry, I say. How did he die? Not to pry. No, that's okay. He waves me off. He had a brain aneurysm. Healthy as a horse, worked out regularly. Then, all of a sudden, he dropped dead. He just dropped. I'm so sorry. Yeah. Justin puts his hands on his hips. The truth? I don't even remember him. I was only 4. That's why I keep the photograph around. He waves his hand around the room. And that's how I have money. A healthy life insurance policy. Sure. He works his jaw. I'd give it all back to have a father. He claps his hands, shakes himself free of the memory. Now, Miss Murphy, have you eaten? Have I? Oh, listen, that's not... Did you eat, ma'am? It's a simple yes or no question. I chuckle again. No. He nods in the direction of his kitchen. I have cold cuts and some cheese and crackers, maybe even some fruit. I'd like some myself. That sounds great, I concede. He starts to leave, but turns and spins. And what are we drinking? I can't tell if you need coffee or wine. I look at him. Wine, we say together. He returns first with 2 glasses of Chardonnay. Cheers, he says. Our second date. I realize my hands are shaking as I clink glasses with him. You're trembling, he says. He puts his hand on my free one. You're safe here, Jenna. Just relax. I nod and take a sip. It's on the sweeter side, but alcohol feels good right now. A little numbing of the anxiety. I'll get the snacks. He pops off the couch and heads into the kitchen. Justin's right. Isaac would never look for me here. I'm safe for tonight. But so much to do. I have to reach out to Ricketts to see what my status is. I need to find out more about Holden the 6th. I have his lawyer's name, but... No, Justin's right about that too. I have to slow down. If I don't get some sleep, I'm gonna fall apart. I look over the room. Picture windows on 2 sides. Expensive leather furniture. A big screen TV mounted on 1 wall. An oak bookcase lining another wall. A nice, handsome, rich guy. Yeah, run away from this one, Murphy. You wouldn't want to be happy and comfortable, would you? You look more relaxed now, he says. He's carrying a tray of cheese and salami, some sliced tomatoes and grapes, a small fancy knife, the Chardonnay bottle tucked under one arm. He sets it all down and sits next to me on the couch. Now eat, he says. And drink, and be merry. I pick a couple of grapes off the bunch and pop them in my mouth. You're spoiling me, I say. I show up unannounced with the cops on my tail and you spoil me. When he doesn't respond right away, I turn to him. He's watching me. Maybe I like spoiling you, he says, touching my hair. Is this guy for real? Are there actually guys like this out there? In that other world, I mean, the one Justin mentioned, where people are truly decent and honest. And handsome, too. He leans into me slowly, giving me the chance to decide, and I lean into him as well. This kiss is better than last time. Less inhibited, more natural. Each of us more at ease. He pulls back. You can stay here as long as you need to, he says. You're safe here. And then we both hear it. Footsteps from a distance. From behind us. Outside. And then a piercing smash as something or someone comes crashing through the picture window. Chapter 83. Shards of glass everywhere. Something hard striking my head, and Justin and I are thrown from the couch as another body sails into us. All three of us hit the hardwood floor. Darkness, chaos, and shouting, and thumping, and grunting, and smashing. Darkness. I open my eyes, my head reeling, my vision blurred. Justin and Aiden struggling on the floor. Aiden on top with the knife raised. Justin grabbing his arm to hold him off, telling myself to move, begging my arms and legs to work, the room angled sideways, spinning. Move! I lunge forward, both hands aiming for the knife. The knife, the most important thing. Disarm the suspect, disable the weapon. All my body weight plowing into Aiden, both hands gripping his wrist, sending Aiden and me over Justin to the floor. I hit the floor again, hard. Colorful bursts dancing around my eyes. But I have the knife. Behind me, the shuffling of feet. With everything I can muster, I manage to crane my neck around. Just as Aiden Willis is climbing up on the couch and jumping out through the window the same way he came. Justin moans, blood coming from his forehead, his breathing shallow. Around us, chaos. A piece of lawn furniture. The one that helped Aiden break through the window. The one that smacked me in the temple, lying by the bookcase. The glass table overturned. Food everywhere. Broken glass littering the couch and floor. And blood. Justin's blood. And mine, some of which is spilling into my eyes right now from the head wound. Are you okay? I ask.
Yeah,
he says, short of breath. He props himself up on his elbows, several cuts across his cheeks and forehead from the glass. Nothing too serious, nothing life-threatening.
How about you?
Were you cut? I crawl toward him. By the knife, I mean. He shakes his head. He looks about as stunned as I am.
What the hell just happened?
The wind gusting through the open, shattered window. We have to call the police, I say. Just now, catching my breath.
But,
Justin forces himself to sit up, grimacing.
If there's a warrant for your arrest, you can't be.
It doesn't matter. We have to report this. He reaches over and grabs my hand. I squeeze back. After a moment, we help each other to our feet. He brings me close, hugging me, our chests heaving, our hearts pounding in tandem.
So sorry, Justin, I say into his chest. I brought this to you. I never should have come here.
No.
He cradles my head with his hand.
I want you here.
I think you just saved my life, I say.
I'm just glad you're okay. And here I told you you were safe.
I close my eyes and nestle in the comfort of his arms. I was safe. Or at least I should have been safe. How did Aiden even know I was here? I wasn't followed in my car. I checked the rearview mirror the whole time for patrol cars. The streets were deserted. Nobody followed me by car. So how did Aiden know?
Nobody knew I was coming here. Then my eyes pop open. A chill courses through me. One person knew. Chapter 84. The East Hampton Town Police respond to Justin's call. I know some members of that force from working on the multi-jurisdictional drug task force, but I don't know any of the ones who arrive at the scene. It's clear the officers know who I am when I give them my name, thanks to the Noah Walker trial. They are respectful and courteous as they scribble their notes and take photographs and scan the living room and backyard for evidence. I sit quietly for hours, letting them do their work, waiting for one of them to inform me that there's a warrant outstanding for my arrest or an APB from the STPD. But it doesn't happen. No handcuffs come out. No perp walk. They just promise to keep us updated on their investigation and leave. An armed invasion in East Hampton is something the cops take seriously. So I know they're going to be looking hard for Aiden now. Which also means that if Aiden has a single functioning brain cell in his head, he's in the wind now. Gone. Skedaddled. I'm sorry about this, I say to Justin. He was after me, not you. I brought him to your house. He brought himself. Justin touches my arm. You're the good guy, remember? Not sure about that. I'd say Justin's the good guy. And damn it, I really wish my feelings for him went deeper than that. I wish I could manufacture some chemistry, a spark between us. The wind whips up, straining the large pieces of cardboard that we use to cover the shattered window. I have to go, I say. Stay. It's after 4 in the morning, and you can't go home. I probably can go home, actually. Apparently, Isaac's plan to take care of me doesn't include issuing a warrant for my arrest for breaking into Aiden's house. So yeah, I can probably go home. But I won't. Not yet. Aiden's surely not home after all. What better time to visit his house again? Chapter 85. I park my car on the shoulder of the road, just as I did last night, and I approach his house with caution, just as before. First blush, I see nothing different about Aiden's house. The front window through which I climbed, almost grabbing Aiden as he raced past me to his bedroom, is still open. If Aiden had come back, surely he would have closed it. Same deal in the backyard. His bedroom window still open. Isaac didn't close up the house? Not his job, I suppose. And he was probably distracted. Or maybe not. Maybe he knew I'd come back. Maybe I'm walking into a trap. The front window would be an easier entry point, but the backyard is more private, nothing but a sloping yard and swaying trees and total darkness. I climb into the bedroom and stand for a moment, silent. Hard to hear much of anything inside the house. Wind coming in from windows in the front and back simultaneously, like the entire house is whistling to me. Daylight will come in an hour. I want to be home by then. Start with the bedroom. A battered dresser with a framed photograph on top, one of those side-by-side frames. On the left, a beautiful young woman, probably in her late teens, with strawberry blonde hair and elegant features. On the right, the same woman, propped up against pillows in a hospital bed, her face pale, her hair unkempt, no makeup, but a radiant, beaming smile as she holds a newborn. Pretty much a standard post-birth hospital photo. I remove the hospital photo and flip it over. On the back, handwritten in cheap blue ink. Aiden and Mommy, 6-8-81. Aiden is a baby. And this very attractive woman, his mother. He doesn't look a thing like her. Then again, I haven't seen the father yet. I replace the photos and open some drawers, having no interest in his clothes or underwear, but hoping for anything else that might be tucked away in here. When I get to the final drawer, I don't find clothes at all. I find a small photo album, a cheap one you'd get at a convenience store with plastic sleeves to hold the photos. Most of them are of his mother, going back as far as the hospital photo. Little Aiden, with those raccoon eyes even as an infant, appears once or twice. And I get the first shot of the father, his cheek pressed against Aiden's, smiling for the camera. A strong resemblance to Aiden. Deep-set eyes and straw-colored hair, not by any means a handsome man. But the mother dominates these photos. About 20 photos in all, starting with the hospital and moving forward, chronologically, I assume. But she looks different as time moves on in these photos. Not older, but different. Hard to tell how much she has aged. Not too much, a year or two at most, but a definite change. Her eyes darker, deeper, looking more gaunt, more tired. Sick? Can't tell, but darker, for sure. More troubled, more weary as the photos progress. Like I'm watching the story of her decline in time-lapse photography. And then the last photo, her head turned for the camera, her hand raised in a stop gesture, as if she didn't want to be photographed. And a baby bump, unmistakable, protruding from her belly beneath her black t-shirt. My heartbeat kicks up. A second child? The last page doesn't contain photos. It contains two news clippings, one of them a vertical column, the other merely a headline and photo. Old articles, each of them, faded with the crispy texture of aged newspaper. The vertical column, stapled to the album page, has this headline: Hit and Run Kills BH Woman. They're talking about Aiden's mother. Gloria Willis, age 30, of Bridgehampton, pronounced dead at Southampton Hospital after being hit by a car on Sugar Hill Road the previous night. The article claims she had several priors for prostitution and drug possession. Her blood analysis revealed the presence of narcotics and alcohol in her system at the time of her death. The article is cut out of the bottom quarter of a newspaper page, so there's no date. But it can't be that hard to find out when Aiden's mother died. Gloria Willis was a drug addict and a prostitute? Holden the Sixth liked prostitutes. It seemed to be a family trait, in fact. The other news clipping isn't even an article. It's a photo, likewise ripped from the center of the newspaper and thus undated. The photo shows Uncle Lang, in his chief's uniform, holding a child swaddled in blankets. Beneath it, this caption: Newborn abandoned at police station. Southampton Town Police Chief Langdon James holds a newborn child left abandoned at the entrance to the Bridgehampton substation last night. The infant will be turned over to the Suffolk County Division of Child Protective Services. What does this all mean? Is this abandoned child Aiden? No. No, of course not. There are photographs of Gloria and Aiden in the hospital at birth. The baby bump. The second child. I close the photo album and leave the bedroom. In the kitchen, there is a door that could possibly be a door to a pantry, but my money says it's a door to the basement. The basement with those wax figures arranged perfectly, like a family portrait. It's time I got a better look at them. Chapter 86. I open the basement door, flip on the switch, and head downstairs. The basement is unfinished, with an aging washer and dryer, an unused sink. I walk toward the back of the basement, the part I saw through the open window last time. But this time, the lights are on. The creepy wax figures, the Norman Rockwell setting around a coffee table, the faux fireplace. On the love seat, the wax figure of the man in a tweed coat, hair greased back, beady eyes, looking a lot like the man in the photo album. In the rocking chair, the woman, seated and wearing a shawl over her shoulders. A dead ringer for Aiden's mother. A third chair, empty. For Aiden? For Aiden to sit down here and play Let's Pretend with his family? Weird. Creepy. Sad, actually. I get a closer look at the woman and see for the first time something I didn't notice when I was shining a flashlight in here from the backyard. On the floor, next to the woman's chair, a tiny toy crib for an infant. Not a wax figure this time. Just a doll. A naked doll.
a tiny, bald newborn swaddled in blankets. A newborn.
Trying to connect it now. Aiden at the cemetery, urinating on the tombstone of Holden the Sixth. Holden the Sixth, the man notorious for frequenting prostitutes. Gloria Willis, a prostitute, in that photo, pregnant with a second child. The caption from the photograph in the paper, newborn abandoned at police station.
Shit, I mumble. That's it.
Gloria Willis had two children. Aiden first, then a child she gave up at birth, abandoned anonymously at the police station. And why would she abandon her son at the police station anonymously? Because she didn't want him? Because she didn't want a child whose father was a monster? Because she didn't want the father to ruin the son? I don't know. There are still some questions. But at last, finally, I might have a few answers. Aiden Willis had a brother. Or more accurately, a half-brother, whose biological father was Holden Dahlquist VI. And somehow, in some way, that abandoned boy found his way back into dear old dad's life.
Book 6, Bridgehampton, 1993 to 1994. Chapter 87. Tonight, it will be the beach. Sometimes it's a park. Sometimes one of the taverns as it's closing and drunk patrons are stumbling out. The beach is always the best, because there's always someone there, and they're asleep, unaware, easy prey. His trombone case feels heavy. The boy alternates hands as he carries it along Ocean Drive toward the Atlantic, the beach, just past 2 in the morning. The wind coming sharply off the ocean, darkness and roiling, chaotic waves, and light. 3 small beacons of light, lanterns, or some form of them, for the beach bums, the ones not comfortable sleeping in pitch darkness. He knows how they feel. He slept with the closet light on for years, his mother yanking on the shoestring to turn it on, then sliding closed the closet door, leaving it open just a crack. He'd beg for another inch for additional light, and they'd negotiate it every night. She usually let him win. Kind of funny, though, that they'd sleep out here on the beach in a natural setting and still require the comfort of artificial light. What are they afraid of? Scary monsters? What scares you? Dr. Conway always asks him. Scary monsters, things like that? Or does something else scare you? The boy climbs to the small perch where the parking lot meets the sand. He opens the trombone case and removes the BB rifle, fully loaded. Safely enveloped in darkness, further shielded by the wild grass on his perch, he closes his left eye and nestles his right eye against the rifle's scope, slowly moving the barrel of the air gun through the deep blackness, through the dark, until he finds the small glow of light.
You want to know how I feel, Doctor?
When the rifle's sight is perfectly aligned with the lantern, when the circular scope is filled with nothing but the yellow-orange glow, he pulls the trigger. A quick, hollow clink as the glass breaks and the light disappears. Over the wind, over the rush of the crashing waves, he hears it ever so faintly. Movement, rustling. Someone jarred awake. He imagines that person's reaction, disoriented, confused, alarmed, and worse, not knowing. Not knowing whether he should be scared, not knowing whether he's safe, not knowing whether something really bad is about to happen.
That's how I feel, Doc. That's how I feel, all the time.
The boy places the rifle back in the trombone case and slides down from the sandy perch. He steps back onto the pavement of the parking lot and heads north. The house, the murder house, on his right, just 2 houses from the beach. He knows the house. His mother comes here once a week for her job. He stops at the iron gate, looks up at the sad monster of a mansion, at the gargoyles and the spears on the roof, aimed at the sky, as if angrily threatening the gods, A loud, sudden noise, the slap of doors flying open, wood hitting wood. The boy crouches down, fear swirling inside. A man's mumbling, angry voice carrying in the wind. The house still dark, but the boy finds it. The second floor, south end. His eyes adjust. He makes out a bedroom. A balcony that wraps around the west and south sides. Double doors flung wide open. A man. The man. It must be him. Six, they call him. Or number six. Or just the sixth. But it's him. Holden Dahlquist, the sixth. Shirtless, hair blowing in the wind, leaning over the balcony, looking down. Trying to get his leg up on the top of the railing that borders the balcony. Trying to stand on top of it. The boy gently places his trombone case on the ground, unlocks the latches, removes the air gun. Looks through his scope, moving through darkness until he finds the man, illuminated by the bedroom light behind him. With a final thrust, the man pushes himself onto the top of the railing. He rises, wobbly, standing on a narrow perch, a tightrope walker getting his balance. He's only on the second story, but this is no ordinary house. The man must be 30-40 feet up. No way he'd survive a fall, especially when his landing would most likely be on the spiked fence below him. The man arches his back, raises his arms as if beseeching the heavens, as if preparing to jump, as if preparing to fly off the balcony to another world. The boy watches all of this through the rifle scope. He pulls the trigger. The man takes the blow, staggers, flutters on his perch, his arms doing tiny circles, his legs buckling, before he falls backward onto the balcony. Aim, fire, click. The boy can do it well. He fires 2-3 pellets at the man. The man, injured from his fall, confused, reacts to each shot, jumping with surprise before scurrying back into the bedroom, out of sight. The boy smiles. Then he packs up his rifle and runs back to his house. Chapter 88. The boy returns the next day, an itch he has to scratch. He hasn't stopped thinking about the man. Can't get the images from last night out of his head. No trombone case this time, and this time during the day. No school today, and Mom says dinner isn't until 2. Ocean Drive is empty. The beach is empty. Even the beach bums, the drifters, have found someplace else to be today. It seems like everybody has someplace else to be on Thanksgiving. The boy slips through the iron gates. It takes some effort, but he's small enough. He walks into the front yard, which slopes upward to the house, colorful leaves dancing all around him, the air brittle with cold, the wind coming off the ocean downright treacherous. He's staring at the monument by the fountain. Cecilia, oh Cecilia, life was death disguised. When he hears the noise in the back, he rushes to the back of the house, his feet crunching the blanket of leaves. The first thing he sees, a rope dangling from a tree branch, knotted in such a way that an oval circle hangs down, bobbing in the wind. A noose. He knows the word for it. That's a noose. A ladder, a man. The man, it's him. Standing on the top rung, reaching for the noose, struggling to fit it over his head, crying, sobbing, cursing. And then suddenly noticing him, a trespasser, a boy, having just come around the corner.
Get out of here, kid.
His words thick and slurred, the noose in his hands not yet around his neck. He is so terrified, he can't respond to Mr. Dahlquist.
I said, get out. Get.
The man swaying, the ladder rocking, the man losing his grip on the noose as the ladder topples over, the man falling with the ladder to the blanket of leaves below with a muted thump. The man cursing, then sobbing, his shoulders heaving, punching the ground, swatting leaves, gripping his hair, grunting and screaming like something inside him is trying to get out. Then he stops. He's worn himself out. He looks around and he finds the bottle, half filled with some brown liquid, obscured by the leaves. He unscrews the top and takes a long guzzle, empties most of the bottle, wipes his mouth with his sleeve. Then he turns and looks at the boy.
It was you last night, says Holden Dahlquist the Sixth,
the words struggling to escape his mouth, heavy and blurry. The boy doesn't answer, doesn't confirm, doesn't deny. But he walks toward the man.
You my guardian angel or something?
The boy stops short in front of him. Mr. Dahlquist, dressed in a flannel shirt and pajama bottoms, yanks open the right side of his shirt, ripping off a button, revealing a small, deep red wound.
You shot me last night.
His eyes red and heavy and unfocused, his face unshaven but handsome. Thick auburn hair, tall and lean. And then the boy sees the handgun, nestled in the leaves, 3 feet from him and 3 feet from Mr. Dahlquist. The boy reaches down and picks it up. It is tiny and light, gold and silver, a short barrel, a big looping circle in the middle of the brass grip. Nothing like the guns that cops have or that you see on TV.
My great-grandfather's revolver, says Mr. Dahlquist. Over 100 years old. A knuckle duster.
The boy wraps his fingers in a circle. Can't even find the trigger.
I'm a good shot, the boy says.
The man's eyes grow wide for a moment, his lips parting. His eyes shift from the gun to the boy.
That gun's loaded, he says. It has bullets.
I know what loaded means.
Mr. Dahlquist stares at the gun, as if lost in a deep dream, his body swaying slightly, his chest heaving.
Give it to me, kid.
The boy doesn't move. He cocks the gun, which produces the trigger, protruding against his index finger.
What are you doing?
Mr. Dahlquist reaches out with his hand, palm open.
Give me it!
He lets out a noise, air whooshing out of him, and pushes himself to his feet, unsteady. The boy doesn't move, holding the gun, aiming it at the man. The sensation it brings, the feeling of power, control, over another person. The boy isn't scared anymore. For the first time he can remember, he isn't scared or confused. He feels in control. For the first time in his life, he's composed, in command. He relishes that feeling. He doesn't ever want to lose that feeling. He wants to remember that feeling forever. He doesn't ever want to go back to those other feelings he has. He puts the barrel of the gun against his temple. Mr. Dahlquist raises his hands, palms out.
No!
The boy pulls the trigger. Nothing but a loud click against his temple. He cocks the gun again, pulls the trigger again. Nothing again. The boy hurls the gun like a tomahawk across the yard, adrenaline swirling inside him, his heartbeat rattling against his chest. Mr. Dahlquist, chest heaving, eyes bugged out, looks at the boy, then at the gun in the grass, then back at the boy.
You think about doing that a lot? Killing yourself?
The boy doesn't answer.
Every day, he thinks. I think about it every day, every hour, every minute.
Me too, says Mr. Dahlquist.
Like the man can read his thoughts, like he's the first person who understands him.
Good thing that gun's 100 years old.
And then Mr. Dahlquist starts laughing. He laughs for a long time, wiping at his eyes. The boy doesn't know what's so funny.
We're quite a pair. Can't even kill ourselves, right?
Holden Dahlquist the Sixth brushes himself off.
I'm cold. Are you cold, kid?
He picks up his bottle, drinks the remaining liquid, and staggers toward the house. The boy follows him inside. Chapter 89. A secret. That's part of what has made these last 6 months so fun. It's a secret, the two of them. Nobody knows he comes over every day after school. Not his mother, not his friends. Nobody knows about his new and special friend, Holden. Well, 6 days a week, not seven. His mom comes here once a week. The boy doesn't come on that day. But all the other days, the boy slips through the gate and comes around the back.
Did you kill yourself today? He asks Mr. Dahlquist.
Nope. Did you?
Nope.
Their running joke.
I won't, if you won't,
Holden always says at the end.
Promise?
Sometimes Holden looks happy to see him. Most days, he doesn't look happy about anything else. Always unsteady on his feet, always reeking of alcohol.
My medicine, he calls it,
always slurring his words, forcing them out in small spurts. Every day there is a chore, and the reward of $10. Usually the task is really small, like raking a meager pile of leaves or shoveling snow off the front walk or washing a few dishes. The boy can tell that most of this work has already been done by someone else, and only a small portion of the project has been reserved for him. Most days they talk, the boy mostly. He tells Holden stories about his life, or his day at school, or things that bother him. Holden doesn't like to talk about himself, or even his family, for some reason. He likes to listen more than talk. The boy watches Holden sometimes, even when he doesn't come in for a visit, standing outside the gate and just watching. Holden doesn't leave the house very much. He lives alone, save for the servant who comes in every other day to clean and cook and run errands. He doesn't have any other visitors, except the pretty women who come by once in a while and stay for a few hours, looking disheveled and sometimes bruised, sometimes limping when they leave. Holden doesn't like to talk about them either. Sometimes Holden paints, sometimes he reads, always he drinks. Canvases fill his upstairs, nearly all of the artwork dark, macabre. Storms ravaging houses, angry oceans, portraits of people dying, sometimes in bloody, grisly fashion, spears protruding through their midsections, gaping wounds in their chests, anguished, tortured faces, death and destruction.
You don't have to come here every day, Holden tells him one day.
I want to.
You have friends your age, kids in school?
Not really,
he says, when the true answer is a hard no.
I'm not really.
The boy isn't sure how to finish the sentence.
They're not like me.
Holden turns away from his artwork and looks at him, appraises him.
I'm not like them, the boy says.
Holden nods.
I'm like you,
the boy does not say. His other secret, the one he hasn't even told Holden, the journal. Or diary, whatever you call it. The thick book bound in red leather, more than 200 years old, which the boy found around Christmas time in Holden's parlor, wrapped in plastic for preservation. He doesn't understand every word of what's written in that journal. Some of the words he has to look up in a dictionary, but he gets the gist of it. Some passages he reads and rereads. He doesn't dare dog-ear the pages, but he slips makeshift bookmarks into those pages. From Winston the Patriarch.
I've come to surrender my inhibitions and any pretense of civility. I may be able to fool the authorities, but I am far too advanced in age to fool myself. There is a monster inside me. It can sleep for days, for months, but it will never go away. It will feast on me, prey on me, until the day I die.
From Holden III, Winston's great-grandson. The lust has taken up permanent residence within me. I can no longer resist it, any more than I can resist my very existence. Blessing or curse, it is now my identity. I will use an axe, and I will watch Anna bleed. And then, I will pray for death.
Holden the Sixth.
Like Winston before me, I have surrendered. I can say that I'm filled with remorse over the four dead tourists. But in fact, what swims inside me is neither dread nor sadness, but relief.
They can't help it. That's what they're saying. It's not their fault. They can't stop it. It's part of them. It's outside their control. They don't want to do it. They have to do it. He reads it every day. It makes him feel different. It makes him feel better. As if something inside him is blossoming, something changing, like a drug releasing its contents into his bloodstream. He's not the only one. He's not the only one who feels like there's a monster inside him. And he knows that Holden's just like him too. No matter how hard he tries to resist it, Holden's no different from him, no different from his ancestors. So he will wait. It may take months. It may take years. He will wait for the moment when Holden is ready to show everyone what lies inside him. Book 7, Bridgehampton, 2012. Chapter 90. It's late. So late that now it's technically called early, pre-dawn, nearly 5 in the morning. The man who sometimes thinks of himself as Holden positions the note card carefully on the desk, his fingers covered in rubber gloves. He considers cutting the words out of a magazine or newspaper like an old-fashioned ransom note, but there is no time for that, so he will write with his non-dominant hand to avoid detection by any handwriting expert. Again, this is him being smart. The words come out wobbly, especially the words bodies and Aiden for some reason, but they're legible, which is all that matters. He closes up the envelope, but, of course, does not lick the adhesive. That would be something, wouldn't it? After all this time to make a mistake like that, leaving his DNA on the envelope? On his way, he makes a detour and turns down Ocean Drive. It's still dark, and nobody will see him. He likes to visit this time of the day. When he reaches 7 Ocean Drive, he steps out of his car and crosses the street to the magnificent wrought iron gates, leans against them, pokes his nose between the bars. He can't fit between the bars anymore.
"Bet you never expected this, did you, Holden?" he whispers.
Who could have expected this turn of events? But it's happening. He pushes himself off the gate and returns to his car. It's not far from dawn, and he wants to deliver the note under the cover of darkness. He throws the car into drive and heads back toward town. It isn't difficult to find the car, parked on the street, and nobody is out at this hour. He tucks the note on the windshield, safely and securely beneath the wiper blade, like a flyer advertising a liquidation sale at a sporting goods store, or a buy one, get one free at some fast food restaurant. This note, of course, has a bit more gravity to it than a coupon. This note's going to turn everything on its head.
Chapter 91. I leave Aiden's house and get home before dawn. My apartment is a slum. Papers strewn about, the bed unmade, unwashed glasses in the kitchen sink. A musty smell. I'm exhausted but propped up by the hum of adrenaline. I look again at the newspaper photo I pilfered from Aiden's scrapbook with the caption, "Newborn abandoned at police station." I must be right. It makes everything fit. Aiden's mother, a prostitute, had a second child, one fathered by Holden the Sixth. She gave the boy up for some reason, because she didn't want a child fathered by Holden, or because she didn't want Holden to have any influence over him. But in some way I can't possibly know, father and son were reunited. But then, why is Aiden a part of this? How does he figure in? And more importantly, who is that second child? Aiden's half-brother. Is it Isaac Marks? He seems to be working with Aiden against me. Is it Noah? He's the one who must have tipped off Aiden that I'd be with Justin last night,
when Aiden came through the window and tried to kill me. Isaac and Noah, each of them a grade younger than Aiden. Three kids who grew up together, who went to school together. Did they learn more than reading, writing, and arithmetic while they were in school together? I'm buzzed but exhausted at first light. Everyone else is just beginning to waken, to start a new day, and I'm about to collapse. My brain is fuzzy from sleep deprivation. I have a lot to do, but I can't function without sleep. Bam, bam, bam. Let me out. Buzz, buzz, buzz. Please, let me out. Buzz, buzz, buzz. My eyes pop open, mid-dream, adrenaline swirling. My cell phone vibrating. I pat the bed until I find it, pick it up, stare at it through foggy eyes. The caller ID says Noah Walker. A flutter through my chest. I'm not ready to answer it. I wait until the buzzing ends. A new voicemail message pops up. I look at the clock. It's 1 in the afternoon. Wow, I slept for almost 6 hours. It felt like 6 minutes. Then I play the voicemail.
Murphy, it's Noah. Just want to make sure you're okay. I have an idea I want to run by you. Give me a call.
I punch out the phone and drop it on the bed. He has an idea he wants to run by me? Yeah, I have something to run by you too, Noah. Why don't you explain to me who told Aiden Willis that I'd be at Justin's house last night? And by chance, were you adopted? Were you left abandoned at the police station as a child? Did you later discover that your biological father was part of a family line of deranged killers going back centuries? Did you decide to pick up the mantle where they left off? And was I, Detective Jenna Murphy, the dumb shit who sprang you from prison? I move slowly, as if I'd been drugged last night, as if I'm recovering from a hangover. I eat some toast and drink some coffee and sit under a cascade of scalding shower water until the hot water runs out. Which, in my apartment, doesn't take very long. My cell phone rings again. I find it in the bathroom through the steam. Noah, again. I ignore it. Again. Somehow, it's 4 in the afternoon now. I have to find Holden Dahlquist's son. If that baby was abandoned at the police station, he would have been turned over to Child Protective Services, like the news clipping said. He would have entered the system. They would have been adopted or placed in a foster home. Something that would have generated a paper trail. Did the child trace that paper trail back to Holden? Or did Holden trace that paper trail back to the boy? I don't know, and I don't care. Because however it happened, a paternity suit, an adoption, whatever, Holden would have involved his attorney. And I have his lawyer's name, thanks to Noah. So how do I get this information from Holden's lawyer, who will assert his attorney-client privilege? No clue. All I know is that I'm getting closer, shaking some trees, and people are getting nervous. Maybe all I can do is wait for their next move. My phone rings again. It's Lauren Ricketts. Hey there, I say.
Murphy,
her voice excited, breathless. What's going on?
You're not gonna believe this.
I push my laptop computer aside. Try me.
Annie Church and Dee Dee Paris, she says. We just found their bodies.
I close my eyes. Somebody, Aiden, Isaac, Noah, just made their next move. Chapter 92. My third time in 2 days driving in this neighborhood, but this time it's not directly to Aiden Willis's house. And this time, traffic is at a standstill, log jammed as far as the eye can see, traffic down to a single narrow lane on the turnpike. I inch forward until I reach the barricades blocking access to the very road on which Aiden Willis lives. TV crews have lined up their vans and satellite feeds, well-coiffed reporters taking their turns before the cameras with their microphones. Once past the barricade, the turnpike opens up again, so I head north another quarter mile to Tasty's, where I park in the lot and head back to the scene on foot. 2 bodies discovered in the woods, almost directly behind Aiden Willis's property line in the backyard, buried 10 feet below ground. That was all I got from Lauren Ricketts, one of the officers on the scene. She didn't have much time to talk to me. I was lucky to get as much as she gave me. I walked down to the barricaded street. A reporter from one of the local stations, a guy with hair so brittle from hairspray that he could weaponize it, recognizes me. He probably doesn't know I've lost my badge. Either way, he allows me inside the van and shows me the feed his station's helicopter is getting. An overhead shot. The overhead view? A lot of the work has already been completed. A bulldozer has already excavated the dirt, and a crane has somehow lifted the bodies out of the crater. The team is on the ground. Officers and forensic investigators and medical examiners. Two gurneys are loaded into a hearse and driven off the property. I step out of the news van. 5 minutes later, I see the hearse approaching the turnpike barricade, officers removing the barriers to allow it to leave. Annie and Dee Dee. Why now? And how did it happen? I send a text message to Ricketts. I'm here on the scene when you have a minute. It will be a while, I expect, before her work is done. But 30 seconds later, I get a reply. Where? I text back, then wait. Ricketts, looking the worst for wear, dusty and dirty, like a soldier emerging from battle, but excited, too, approaches the barricade. It's Annie and Dee Dee? I ask. She nods. I think so. One of the fingers was missing. Right. He cut off one of Dee Dee's fingers and left it for the cops to find a few years ago. The knife was there too, she says. The murder weapon. Wow. He left the murder weapon with the girls? Our killer was probably too careful to leave fingerprints on the knife, but you never know. I found the bodies, Ricketts says. It was me. I put my hand on her shoulder. How the heck did that happen? Well, that's the thing. Someone put a note on my windshield this morning. I draw back. What? Ricketts looks around at the bedlam, the reporters and onlookers practically shutting down the turnpike. A note said I could find their bodies back here, by the large elm tree with the X in red spray paint. She shrugs. Why would someone do that? Why would someone write me a note? I think about that. But she knows the answer same as I do. The note was written to her because she was working on this case with me. Whoever did this, he wants you to know, she says. Since I'm the responding officer, it's my case. I have access to all the data. He wants you to have the information, Murphy. He knows I'll tell you. She's right. It makes sense. Aiden didn't work alone, I say. There are at least two people doing this. Aiden and someone else. Maybe two somebody else's. Someone who knows we're working on this case together. She thinks about it, nods. So what do we do now? Do your job, I say. Find out all you can, and then, when it's safe, you and I should work through this. Okay, right. Okay. Ricketts takes a deep breath. This is a big moment for her. It's not every day a rookie patrol officer breaks a major unsolved case. Watch your back, officer, I say. They may be trying to communicate with me, but they're using you to do it. I walk back to my car as a light mist begins to fall, my mind racing with questions. He's messing with me now, telling me something, sending me in a certain direction. But which direction? And why? How does showing me Dee Dee's and Annie's bodies help him? My head starts to ache. Another new piece of evidence, yielding nothing but more questions. When I reach my car, Noah Walker is leaning against it, his arms crossed. Hello, stranger, he says to me. Chapter 93. I've been calling you, Noah says. He pushes himself off my car. He's in his construction gear. Jeans and t-shirt, boots, protective vest. Off work now, catching dinner at Tasty's. I feel something between us. Always that radiating heat. But this time more penetrating, turning my stomach sour. I guess you heard about Annie and Dee Dee, I say.
Yeah. You have any information?
None, I say. I'm not on the inside anymore.
But you have that friend, that young cop. What's her name again?
Playing dumb. I'm not going to play back. What do you want, Noah? He opens his hands.
Same thing you want,
he says, like it's obvious.
I thought we were a team.
So did I, before you tried to help Aiden kill me.
What's wrong?
He says. Ask him. Just ask him and see what he says. Were you adopted, Noah? He gives me a funny look.
Adopted? No.
You sure?
Am I sure I wasn't adopted? I think I'd be sure about that.
I look him over, try to read him. I'm not getting a solid hit either way. It's public information, I say. I can find out.
I don't think so,
he answers.
I don't think adoptions are public information.
For a guy who wasn't adopted, you seem to know a lot about them.
Murphy, what the hell?
He steps toward me.
What's with this bizarre interrogation? I've been leaving you messages.
By the way, I say, getting my Irish up now. I went to Justin's last night like I told you I would, and guess who paid me a visit? He shakes his head, playing dumb again. Aiden, I say. He came through a window at me, with a knife.
He what? Are you okay?
I wonder how he knew I'd be there, Noah. Got any ideas? He waves his hand like he's erasing something.
Wait a second. Wait a second. You don't think it was me?
Oh, no, of course not. It was probably the long list of other people who knew I was going to be at Justin's last night. Oh, wait.
Nobody else knew. Murphy, just hold on a second.
He reaches for me, but I pull back.
Don't you touch me, I say.
Don't come near me ever again.
Just know something, Noah. I will figure this out.
You tell your buddies, whoever's a part of this, I'm close. I'm gonna nail all of you or die trying. Noah steps between me and my car.
Okay, you got to talk,
he says.
Now I get to talk.
Get out of my way or you'll be sorry.
Hey!
Noah and I both turn. Justin is jogging toward us from the restaurant.
Is there a problem?
He asks. Noah glares at him, something primitive in his eyes. These two are casual acquaintances. Each has said a kind word about the other, but something passed between Noah and me last night until I mentioned Justin. I remember the look on his face, the blow he suffered, even though I insisted Justin and I are just friends.
Nothing that concerns you,
Noah says to Justin. Justin stops short of us, looks at me.
Jenna? It's none of your business,
Noah says.
You're on my property, Noah, and you're bothering my friend. So I think it is my business. Stay out of this, Justin.
Noah squares off on Justin.
This is a private conversation.
Two men, the macho thing, battling over the damsel's honor. Only this damsel ain't interested. Guys, over here. I wave my hand. I'm leaving. I'll call you later, Justin. And Noah, stay away from me. I climb into my car and slam the door. I start up the engine and throw it into reverse, gravel flying in my wake, then head north on the turnpike, unsure of my destination, only certain that wherever I'm going alone. Chapter 94. I drive home as darkness sweeps over Bridgehampton. Aiden's still out there, and while I seriously doubt he'd be dumb enough to hang around the Hamptons to take another shot at me, I take simple precautions. I lock the deadbolt and prop a chair against the door, and I move the dresser against the small window. It's not much of a deterrent, but at least it will keep Aiden from doing another nosedive through a plate of glass. I have almost nothing in my cupboard but some noodles, so I boil some water and drop them in. Eat and sleep, Murphy, or you'll crumble like a stale cookie. But I have no appetite. My stomach is a pool of nerves and chaos. You're getting closer, Murphy. I push the plate of noodles aside. But you're not there yet. Then two things happen at once, causing me to jump from my seat. My cell phone buzzes and my doorbell rings. The phone is Ricketts. I punch it on while I move to the door. I look through the peephole at the man standing at my door. It's Isaac Marks, our beloved chief of police. "Ricketts, let me call you back," I say into the phone. "Your boss is at the door."
"No, Jenna, wait."
I punch the phone off, release the deadbolt, and open the door. And stare at the man who just might be responsible for the murder of 8 people, including the man he replaced as chief.
"Murphy?"
Isaac says, nodding, wearing his uniform. Probably did some press today on Annie and Dee Dee.
"Need you to come down to the substation,"
he says. "You can talk to me right here." He takes a deep breath, grimaces.
"Don't make this difficult. Come down with me voluntarily. Make a good decision for once in your life."
"You don't have anything better to do?" I ask. "After finding 2 dead bodies today?" He gives me a funny look.
"The 2 dead bodies," he says, "are the reason I'm here."
Chapter 95. I sit in the same interview room where I've sat many times, only on the other side of the table. They used to be good at this, questioning witnesses, sizing them up, reading them, making them sweat, gaining their trust, taking them on a roller coaster ride from fright to horror to despondence to remorse to confession. The door opens and in walks Isaac Marks. He stands against the wall, arms crossed. What is he capable of? Did he kill all those people, with Aiden as his accomplice? And maybe Noah too? Did he do something to me along with Aiden at 7 Ocean Drive when I was a little girl? I've never had a bead on the guy. I was his partner for less than a year and he was a phone-it-in cop. A guy who liked to strut around with the badge, enjoyed the power more than the responsibility. Never one to put in the extra hours necessary. Never one to go the extra mile. But a killer? If it's true, I missed it. Never saw it. Then again, I wasn't looking for it.
"I want some answers, Murphy,"
he says.
"Some straight answers."
"So do I." He shakes his head.
"Doesn't work that way. Maybe you forgot."
"It does now, or I take 5. Most people are afraid to invoke their 5th Amendment rights. They think it makes them look guilty. They're right, but they're wrong. Yeah, you look bad if you won't talk, but how you appear at that moment to a cop pales in comparison to the damage you do by answering detailed questions, locking yourself in. Maybe I should be heeding that advice right now." "The bodies were Annie and Dee Dee?" I ask. Isaac closes his eyes, nods.
"We have a rush on DNA. We won't have it for another day or so. But there was a missing finger and some personal articles on the bodies that the families confirmed. It's not official. But unofficially, there's no doubt."
"How did you make the discovery?" I ask. Still planted against the wall, still stoic, but now with a gleam in his eye. He knows Ricketts and I are friends. He knows I know.
"Anonymous tip,"
he says. "How convenient." He cocks his head.
"Convenient? How so?"
I shrug. Maybe someone was getting too close to solving this whole thing. Maybe Aiden's being given up as a sacrificial lamb. A scapegoat.
"A scapegoat."
Isaac's eyes narrow.
"Meaning he's innocent."
"Meaning," I say, "that he wasn't the only one. He has a partner." Isaac doesn't move. Expression doesn't break. Tough to read because interrogators are playing a role, acting out a scene, so it could just be him doing his job. Or it could be he's sweating bullets underneath that uniform.
"A partner,"
he says.
"2 people?"
"At least 2," I say. "And the partner just fucked Aiden." Isaac pushes himself off the wall and pulls out the chair across from me. He takes his time getting seated, settling in, training his stare on me.
"How did the partner fuck Aiden?"
he asks. My heartbeat ratcheting up. He has me in an enclosed room in his custody. But it's a police station, There are witnesses, other cops watching through the one way. It's not like he can silence me. Do I want to do this? Right here? Right now? Hell yes, I do. With other cops as witnesses. Let's say Aiden was getting nervous, I say. He talks to his partner. He says they're getting close. So his partner tells Aiden to leave town. Get out of Dodge for a while. Let things settle down. Isaac nods, listening intently. Maybe the partner tells Aiden, "Don't worry, I'll take care of this." Isaac does a double blink with his eyes. I've just quoted what he said to Aiden on the phone last night, when he didn't see me hiding outside. "Go on," he says, his voice flat and cold. But once Aiden scrams, his partner makes an anonymous tip to the cops. Bodies are discovered a stone's throw from Aiden's property line. And 10 gets you 20, there's incriminating evidence found at that burial scene. Evidence that implicates Aiden and Aiden alone. My guess? Aiden's fingerprints on the murder weapon. Isaac is silent, his eyes deadened. So now Aiden's an obvious suspect, I say. Gift-wrapped, practically. And his partner walks away scot-free. Isaac takes a breath, leans back in his chair. "Cat got your tongue, Chief?" His fingers tap the table.
"You think Aiden's a part of this?"
"Yes. I've suspected him for a while now. In fact, I tried to confront him last night at his house. He ran from me before I could question him. But you already know that, don't you, Isaac?" The dam has burst. I've all but accused him now. I don't know if this is the smart move here, but I'm running out of options. Smart or not, it's time to move. Isaac tries to smile. It doesn't work very well.
"Tell me more about this second killer," he says.
I shrug. He's lasted this long, 8 murders over 5 years, so he's smart. And he's able to function in society as a normal person. A classic psychopath. He could be anyone. He could be a construction worker. He could be a ditch digger. I look Isaac squarely in the eye. "He could be a cop," I say.
"A cop? Interesting."
Isaac purses his lips.
"Well, Murphy, it turns out we did find Aiden's fingerprints on the murder weapon."
"You have Aiden's prints on file?"
"He was arrested once, a long time ago, for retail theft. Shoplifting. His prints are in the database."
"Did you run all the databases, Chief? Even the government employees' database? Every cop in our department has their prints in that database. Did you remember to check that database too? Or did it slip your mind?" My blood is boiling now. But the cops who are watching this interview need to hear this. All of it.
"You figure," says Isaac, "that if we found another set of prints, we'd have the second person. Aiden's partner.
Worth a shot.
Someone who can act perfectly normal in society. Like a construction worker."
"Or a cop," I say again.
"Yeah, you said that before," he says. "A cop?"
"Why not? It's the perfect cover. He could manipulate the evidence. He could influence the investigation."
"True,"
says Isaac.
"That's true."
I open my hands. "What are you afraid of, Isaac? Check the government database. Or are you worried that maybe your hand slipped and your prints accidentally got on that knife?" Now his smile comes on full glow. He shakes his head.
"We did run the prints on the murder weapon through the government database,"
he says.
"And we got a match."
He rises out of his chair and leans over the table so he can whisper his next words.
"Aiden's prints weren't the only ones on that murder weapon,"
he says.
"We found yours too, Jenna Murphy."
Chapter 96. I spring out of my chair, a slow burn through my chest. "No," I say. "No way!" Chief Isaac Marks is suddenly enjoying himself very much. He sits back in his chair, crosses a leg.
"I suppose now you're going to claim that I manipulated the process somehow. Planted your fingerprints, right?"
My mind racing, My throat full, everything moving too fast.
Well, let me put you at ease, Murphy. I had no part in the gathering of the evidence or in running the prints. If you don't believe me, you can ask your bestest buddy, Officer Ricketts.
The walls closing in. The heat turned way up. This isn't right. It can't be right. You can't possibly think... My throat closes before I can finish the sentence.
I can't possibly think what?
He says whimsically.
That you had something to do with Annie's and Dee Dee's murders? Well, let's think about that. Have a seat, if you would.
I put my hand against the wall to brace myself. My prints are on the murder weapon? That can't possibly be right. Somebody, somehow, must have...
I said sit the fuck down, Murphy.
My legs unsteady. I find the seat and plant myself.
So let's think this through,
he says.
You have very persuasively argued that there were two killers, Aiden Willis and another person. You have also persuaded me that the second killer could be a police officer, that it would be the perfect cover for a psychopath.
I didn't mean me.
So we have two girls who were murdered in the summer of 2007. Since we don't know the exact day or even the exact month of their death, it's impossible to know your whereabouts at the time. You were a cop in Manhattan. But how easy would it have been to drive out here and do this?